So I'm going to be talking this morning briefly about 1967 and offering a social and historical context around that period. So when you think of Bangor in North Wales, you probably don't think of it as a hotbed of spiritual activity. But on the 25th of August 1967, the Beatles, accompanied by various wives, girlfriends and friends, jumped on a train from Paddington Station to Bangor, where they went to spend a weekend with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi to explore a weekend on spiritual regeneration. And the Maharishi was over from India to the UK to promote transcendental meditation, or TM. Now, the Beatles were informed that for the pricey sum of 7 shillings and 6 pence, that each of them would receive inner peace through exploring meditation. And they were each given a special mantra in which they could take away and use. So why am I sharing this story with you? So my experience of growing up as a teenager in the 1980s, the myth of the Beatles cast a strong, intoxicating spell over me. As I tried to make sense of my life and its direction, the creative explorations of the Beatles inspired me, from their experimentation with drugs such as LSD, to ideas around Eastern mysticism, meditation, yoga, even vegetarianism. The idea that you could explore your consciousness, your mind, through meditation was something that fascinated and intrigued me. I think it's fair to say that my journey from attending my first meditation class in the early 90s to going on retreat, exploring meditation, Buddhism, my involvement with Triaratna, my exploration of yoga, has come from the seeds sown by the Beatles and the 1960s underground or counterculture. So I'm sharing this with you because you might be wondering why I've been asked to speak about 1967, as Art of Arden's already mentioned. I wasn't even born in 1967. I'm a child of the 70s and 80s. But I hope my voice offers a perspective, a broad canvas in which we help to get a sense of the multifaceted social and historical conditions and context that gave birth to a new Buddhist movement that we're celebrating its 50th anniversary today here in Sheffield. Now, 1967 was a complex and fascinating year, and in this brief talk I'm not going to be able to fully do justice to all the complex themes and issues of that period. So instead I'm going to try and focus on particularly London in 1967 and the UK, because this is where Sangharaksha founded our movement. I'm also going to spend some time exploring what was known as the underground or counterculture, and how I believe it influenced the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, or Triaratna as we now know it. So the writer Ian MacDonald, in his book Revolution in the Head, has this to say: anyone unlucky enough not to have been aged between 14 and 30 during 1966 to 67 will never know the excitement of those years in popular culture. It was a time of sunny optimism, and this permeated everything. Possibilities seemed endless and limitless. And bestriding the British music scene, or British scene that embraced music, poetry, fashion and film, in which the English football had recently beaten the world, the Beatles were at their peak and were looked up to in awe as arbiters of a new positive age, in which the customs of the older generation would be refreshed and remade anew with the creative energy of the classless young. So on the evening of Thursday, the 6th of April, 1967, in a small basement room in an oriental shop called Sakura on Monmouth Street in the centre of London, with about 20 other people in a small shrine room. Sangharaksha led a dedication ceremony for a new Buddhist movement, which at the time was called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Sangha. Now, some of Sangharaksha's early followers were of an older generation, but he also attracted younger people, men and women who felt he was able more to be able to communicate with and who seemed hungry for change or radical change in their lives. Now, a lot of these young people tended to be from sort of white, educated, middle-class backgrounds and were part of the youthful avant-garde, underground or counterculture. Now, to really understand the context and fertile soil in which our movement was influenced and created and which it grew out of, I feel we need to understand the zeitgeist of or the views and beliefs of the 1960s counterculture that was pivotal particularly to 1967. Now, I'm going to quote from Barry Miles, who was a 1960s social commentator and historian. And he has this to say about the counterculture movement and its views and beliefs. The underground was a community of like-minded, anti-establishment, anti-war, pro-rock and roll individuals, most of whom had a common interest in recreational drugs. The London underground scene was in particular was an uneasy coalition of hedonistic, aristocratic black sheep and young people protesting against the entrenched class system and its values. They experimented with hallucinogenic drugs, and together they evolved a new form of rock and roll. They questioned the sexual morality handed down by the church and state, and they proposed many different models: extended sexual communities, sex orgies, and a tolerance and acceptance of homosexuality, but most of all, a positive, joyful celebration of sexuality. Now, the ideas also of the Beat Generation, which would have been particularly in the 40s and 50s prior to the 60s, were also a huge influence on the counterculture and helped fuel responses to establishment thinking. So writers such as Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, Gary Schneider, these became sort of elder statesmen for the new scene of the 60s counterculture. The counterculture was a very diverse or broad church and was influenced by people as broadly as Herbert Marcuse, the father of the New Left, Timothy Leary, J.D. Salinger, author of Catcher in the Rye, Herman Hesse, Bob Dylan, and of course the Beatles. I want to now just give us a bit of a broader social context of England in 1967. So if you were in the British youth growing up in the late 60s, you were growing up in the shadow of the Second World War. And British society was emerging from a prolonged period of austerity. It's worth remembering food rationing had only ended in 1954. However, by the 1960s, for the first time in Britain, young people had money. So there's full unemployment and relatively cheap accommodation. So if you were young, there was a potential for disposable income and time to spend it. And together with these and other factors, contributed to a new alternative consumer society. Now, if you're a young person in the late 60s, you didn't necessarily earn enough to buy a car, but you had enough money to buy records, books, clothes, drugs, and you could go to clubs. Also, the baby boom of the post-war years meant that by 1963, there were 800,000 more teenagers in the population than there had been a decade before. Also, since 1962, in the UK, mandatory maintenance grants were introduced to cover student fees and living costs. So this meant that university was an affordable and attractive option to a lot of young people, even those that were from a working class background. Now, of course, not every student spent their grant money on what it was meant for. Roger Walters of Pink Floyd fame says he spent a whole term grant on a Rickenbacker guitar. Now, considering the success of Pink Floyd and album sales alone for Dark Side of the Moon, I think we can say that was money well spent. Also, with the 1960s counterculture, there's a strong link between the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, or CND, which was founded in 1957. And there's an argument that a lot of the 1960s counterculture grew out of the CND movement, or was greatly influenced by it, particularly in the UK. So each Easter from 1959 to 63, there were the famous Aldermaston to London CND marches. And these went from Aldermaston, which was near the atomic weapons establishment in Berkshire, to Trafalgar Square in London, and people would join this march or procession over an Easter break or period. And by 1962, 150,000 people attended these annual marches. Now, these marches galvanised the young from a broad spectrum of groups and social backgrounds. You had drug-taking art students, CND activists, the Trotskyites, pacifist priests, so a very broad range of people. And on these marches, people met new friends, explored parts of the country maybe they'd never been to before, had their first boyfriend or girlfriend, maybe lost their virginity, maybe tried smoking marijuana. So they had a whole new experience maybe of life from their maybe teenage or childhood. And the threat of the Cold War and the atomic bomb was very much in the minds of young people in the late 60s. It was in their minds, and they wanted to do something strongly about it. Now, in terms of this 60s counterculture, this underground scene that I'm talking about, you could say the first true galvanized emergence of it began on the 11th of June 1965, when, held at the Albert Hall, there was the International Poetry Incarnation. And 7,000 people turned up to hear a range of different poets, including Allen Ginsberg, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Gregory Corso, Adrian Mitchell, and many others. And for the first time, the people that came to this event looked around and saw that they were surrounded by like-minded people. And out of this zeitgeist, out of this gathering of people, who up to that point didn't really realise how many of them were moving in this direction, friendships were formed, magazines were established, boutiques were opened, relationships started. And for many people also, it was the first time they'd seen the famous American poet Allen Ginsberg. Allen Ginsberg, of course, was the author of Howl and Kaddish. And it's quite a well-known story that Allen Ginsberg, during that year that he was over in the UK, in 65, took to drinking. And unfortunately, he was drunk the night of his performance and gave a rather poor performance, something he later regretted. I've got an interesting anecdotal story regarding this. Many years ago, I met with Bante, and during our time together, I shared with him my love of the Beats, and he shared with me about his friendship with Allen Ginsberg, and he recounted the following story. So apparently, the morning after the famous Albert Hall International Poetry Gathering, Allen Ginsberg went to visit Bante in his flat. And Allen was feeling rather hungover, and a little bit sheepish after this missed opportunity to, you know, perform and for people to see him. And Bhante apparently said to me that he was reading the morning papers and sort of cheekily said to Alan, "Oh, I see you're in the news this morning," and sort of slightly teased him about this drunken performance, which Alan confirmed and said that he slightly regretted. There's a very good film by the director Peter Whitehead called Holy Communion, which captures this poetry event, which is worth watching if you're interested at all. Now, it's not surprising that Allen Ginsberg and Sangharakshita should develop something of a friendship. They had first met in 1962 while Sangharakshita was living in Kalimpong. And this was Allen's first trip to India, which he was travelling with his then boyfriend Peter Olefsky at the time. And it seems from reading Sangharakshita's memoirs of his encounter with Allen Ginsberg that it appears that Allen Ginsberg was probably one of the first openly gay men he had encountered. Now, it might seem an odd friendship between Allen Ginsberg and Sangharakshita, but they both shared a passion for William Blake, poetry, Buddhism, and they were both gay. Now, I'd like to touch upon now some of the social reforms of the late 60s, particularly in the UK, that were affecting us and affecting people living in those times. So on Thursday, the 27th of July, 1967, saw the passing of the Sexual Offences Act. And this decriminalised homosexuality or homosexual acts in private between men over the age of 21. The act had been pushed through from then Labour Home Secretary, Roy Jenkins. And Roy Jenkins, it's worth remembering, was responsible for a lot of social reforms in the UK in particularly the late 60s. And these social reforms were quite wide-ranging. He was responsible for the relaxation of laws relating to divorce, the abolition of theatre censorship, and he also gave support to the legalisation of abortion. And he was seeking to create what he called the civilised society. Now, of course, there was opposition to Roy Jenkins' proposals, particularly from the old guard, who considered this liberalisation of the law a corruption of Christian moral values and the birth of a so-called permissive society. The poet Philip Larkin celebrates these new changes brought about by these social reforms and loosening of restricted laws with the immortal line, "Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was far too late for me." Also in 1961, we'd seen the introduction of the oral contraceptive pill, which was available on the National Health Service. But it's worth remembering that this was only available if you were a married woman. So this meant for a lot of young women who were single or not married, but in a relationship in 1967 in Britain, that unless they lied, they were not able to get the pill. So most doctors at family clinics would refuse to give it to them. Although, having said that, there was legislation passed by the NHS, the Family Planning Act of 1967, which allowed women who weren't married to obtain the pill. Although what was passed as law and actually what happened when you went to the doctors, sometimes there was a large discrepancy. Also in 1967, saw a peak in creativity of pop and rock music in British culture, but also around the world. On the 1st of June 1967, the Beatles released their latest album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And the album was released simultaneously for the first time in America and the UK, and had a huge impact around the world. And it became the soundtrack to what was the press were then coining the Summer of Love. It spent a record 27 weeks at the top of the British album charts and 15 weeks as number one in the US. Time magazine called it a historic departure in the progress of music. And today it's seen as one of the greatest pop albums ever made. Earlier in the year, on Friday the 17th of February, the Beatles released their latest single, Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane, which was released as a double A-side. And the single reached number 2 in the UK singles chart, breaking the band's 4-year chart-topping run. So it was the first time since Love Me Do in 1962 that a Beatles single had failed to reach the number 1 spot. And they were held at bay from the number 1 spot by Inkerbutt Humperdinck's Release Me. Something I've still not forgiven him for. So this is a good example, actually, of the conservative backlash against the counterculture that had begun. So the British record buying public, which would be quite broad, it wouldn't be just teenagers, it would be mums and dads, you know, didn't know quite what to make of this latest Beatles offering, this latest single, Strawberry Fields Forever. But what they did know was that Paul McCartney had admitted to taking the drug LSD in a reporter's interview in May of 67, and that their music was getting stranger, more futuristic, more avant-garde. Love Me Do, it was not. 1967 was also a pivotal year in popular music, popular rock and pop music, where the album became the more dominant form than the single. I mean, single sales were still huge, but the album began to shift as the dominant format in which people would listen to music. And there's quite a compelling consensus that some of the greatest, or at least influential, albums of the last 50 years were released in 1967. So to name just a few, we've got The Velvet Underground at Nikko, The Doors' debut album, Love Forever Changes, Cream, Disraeli Gears, Pink Floyd, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced? Also within the zeitgeist of 67, you had a fascination or interest or deepening interest in Eastern mysticism. On the 29th of September 1967, George Harrison and John Lennon appeared on the David Frost program. And the program was solely dedicated or devoted to exploring transcendental meditation. Now, so much interest was generated by this episode or this program that they were asked back in October. And on this later edition of the show, George Harrison met the Cambridge Sanskrit scholar Juan Mascaro, who would later send him various books. So I think this is a really good example of how by 1967 an interest in meditation, yoga, Eastern religion, mysticism was beginning to filter down into the mainstream. And also into ideas around fashion, clothing, lifestyle. Now the seeds of interest in Eastern mysticism, Eastern religion, and ideas have been building for many years, particularly in bohemian circles. And these included intellectuals such as Aldous Huxley, who wrote the famous papal book, The Doors of Perception, which is a philosophical essay released in 1954. And this details his experience of taking the drug mescaline. And the book title is taken from a William Blake poem, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, in which Blake writes, "If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern." And other writers such as Hermann Hesse, in books such as Siddhartha and Journey to the East, explored man's search for spiritual meaning. Also, the Beat had fallen under the spell of Buddhism and explored meditation. And a good example of this can be found in Jack Kerouac's book, The Dharma Bums. And it's often been said that anyone with an interest in spirituality, particularly Buddhism in the late 60s, would often be found on their bookcase with a copy of Christmas Humphrey's book on Buddhism and possibly Alan Watts' The Way of Zen. Some of the other contributing factors to this interest in Eastern mysticism and religion can be traced to the decline in Christianity particularly in the West, as a meaningful spiritual context or tradition that people could find value in. The other was the increasing spread or use of the drug LSD. Now, LSD had been synthesized in 1938 by a Swiss chemist called Albert Hofmann, who was looking for a cure for migraines. And by the 60s, or particularly late 60s, it had become a hip new thing to explore, particularly among the young hippie counterculture circle, who elevated it to religious-like status. Now, the effect LSD had on the user was an effect altering one's consciousness, allowing them to experience different levels of awareness, sometimes producing visions, an intense heightened state through the senses, particularly when listening to music or engaging with the external world around them. Now, the 60s counterculture, although it had very strong hedonistic values and temperament, there was also a link between drug exploration and the mystical quest for the truth or enlightenment within these experiments. Also, figures such as Timothy Leary, the American ex-Harvard psychology professor, who through his experiments with the drug LSD had begun to preach its benefits to the masses, announcing to the world to turn on, tune in, and drop out. Now, by 1968, Sangharakshita, as well as continuing to teach at Sakura, had begun to teach at Centre House. Now, Centre House, some of you might know of, was a building on 10 Airlie Gardens in London, a corner building, and it had been taken over by a guy called Muzz Murray. Now, Muzz Murray was a spiritual figure, a teacher, and he had various followers, sometimes known as gardeners. And Muzz went on to create a magazine called Gandalf's Garden. And Gandalf's Garden ran for 6 issues, from May 1968 to the winter of 1969. And this counterculture magazine explored mystical interests, UFOs, esoteric religions, meditation, yoga, and particularly advocated meditation or spiritual practices in preference to drugs. And Muzz Murray was the editor of this magazine. Though, although the magazine only ran for a short period, it was very influential. For example, Dharma Dinner, who some of you might know, her involvement with the FDBO at the time came from seeing an advert in Gandalf's Garden magazine, having visited the shop for meditation and Buddhism classes, and she became involved from following that advert. And the rest, they say, is history. But that's maybe a story for another time. But if we look at the small ads that can be found in the back of Gandalf's Garden magazine that Banti placed, we can see that on Friday the 18th of October, this is 1968 now, an introduction to Tibetan Buddhism, which was 5 shillings per lecture. Also, an advert for the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order offering Zen meditation on a Monday night. So clearly an eclectic mix. I want us just to briefly touch upon what could be described as the shadow of the 60s counterculture. So 1967 was a year of tremendous optimism and light. However, it's often said, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow that's cast. Now, the values and activities of the counterculture promised a new revolutionary alternative society. Now, in hindsight, this was rather naive, we could even say rose-tinted. The radical movements of the late 60s never really attracted more than just a minority of young people. A lot of youngsters remained firmly entrenched in the more mainstream values. You know, they're more concerned with just getting married, buying a house, going on holiday. And the nearest most people got to experiencing 60s counterculture in 1967 would probably be hearing Purple Harum's A Whiter Shade of Pale on the radio. So the counterculture's radicalism often proved a thin veneer. despite its sloganeering, sexual inequalities remain pronounced, and some would argue that the sexual revolution often amounted to little more than an intensification of the sexual exploitation of women. And the underground culture of the late 60s was very keen to turn down the rigid conservative values and boundaries, particularly those of the 50s that it felt were restrictive to self-expression and self-freedom. So consequently, in the late 60s, we had this attempted swing of the pendulum in the complete opposite extreme. They wanted to relax boundaries around sexuality, drug use, and lifestyle choices, so on. As we've seen, there's a lot of creativity and opening up of new ideas that were very liberating for a lot of people in the late 60s. But it was also a very confusing, indulgent, naive time. Now, in 1997, the comedian Mike Myers created a film called Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. And in the film, we follow the adventures of a swinging playboy spy living in London in 1967. Now, this character is in the film cryogenically frozen in 1967 and reawakened in 1997. And one of the first things Austin Powers says on being woken up 30 years later is a wonderful but telling joke. So his female assistant, Miss Kensington, says, "Mr. Powers, my job is to acclimatise you to the 90s. You know, a lot's changed since 1967. Austin Powers says, "No doubt, love. But as long as people are still having promiscuous sex with many anonymous partners, without protection, while at the same time experimenting with mind-expanding drugs, in a consequence-free environment, I'll be sound as a pound." So in just a few lines, we get a rather caricatured but nevertheless accurate view or feel for the views held by the swinging counterculture set of the late 60s. Yeah. And we have seen the suffering cause when we act as if our actions don't have consequences or are consequence-free. So some of the views and beliefs held by the counterculture now seem laughable, if not downright dangerous. The ethical and social morals of the late 60s have changed a lot, particularly in relation to sex, but also drug use. It's worth remembering by 1970, Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison would all be dead from drug-related deaths. The optimistic view that a new positive society would usurp the old seems like a faded dream. And by 1970, even John Lennon declared, "The dream is over." So to conclude, so were the young men and women who were swept up in the idealism of the late 60s wrong in thinking that they could change the world? From the viewpoint of history, we might say yes. Some of the idealism of the 60s was naive. But to dismiss the whole movement, I feel, would be pointless, or we're missing something there. If we look back 50 years, the utopian revolution that was dreamed may have not come to pass. But things have changed and have stayed with us. The civil rights movement, feminism, gay liberation, a growing awareness of environmental issues, even vegetarianism, veganism. And more people than ever in the world are exploring Buddhism, yoga, and meditation. In 2017, the planet is in a precarious state, and we live in an age of anxiety with the rise of the right wing in the USA and in Europe. As ever, the world needs love and needs acts of kindness. Kindness towards other human beings, but also acts of kindness towards the planet and the environment. The world still needs love and compassion, but compassion imbued with wisdom. And the Buddha taught that as long as craving, hatred, and ignorance are at the root of our experience, we will continue to cause suffering towards ourselves and others. Now, Allen Ginsberg was asked 20 years later, after 1967 and the Summer of Love, did he still think all you need is love? And he said this, which I'll leave you with. I would say all you need is awareness. And then love proceeds from awareness. I think the saying, all you need is love, is a sentimentalization of love. Because after all, it is a word and anyone can interpret it differently. But I think awareness is a little more ample. Thank you.